The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 2, Continued. Cassette 7, Side 2.
He has to conceal his successes so that they will not be outdone. He has to conceal his plans, his calculations, and his hopes, whether he be preparing for a big escape or has figured out where to collect shavings for a mattress. In the Zek life, it is always the case that to disclose means to lose. One native whom I treated to Makhorka explained it to me this way. I present it here in translation. If you disclose a warm place to sleep where the foreman won't find you, everyone will rush there, and the foreman will smell it out. If you disclose that you have sent a letter out through a free person, then everyone else will hand his letters to that free person, and they will catch him with the letters. An official postal service does exist on the islands of the archipelago, but the natives prefer not to make use of it. And if the storeroom clerk has promised to exchange your torn shirt, shut up till you have exchanged it, and when you have, shut up some more. You won't give him away, and he will be useful to you later on. Compare this proverb among the Russians. If you have found something, shut up, and if you have lost something, shut up too. Frankly speaking, the parallelism of these rules of life leave us somewhat puzzled. With the years, the Zek becomes so accustomed to hiding everything that he no longer has to exert any effort at all to this end. The natural human desire to share what he has experienced dies in him. Should we perhaps recognize in this secretiveness some sort of defense reaction against the secret course of events in general? After all, they also do all they can to conceal from him information concerning his own fate. The secretiveness of the Zek flows also from his all-round mistrustfulness. He mistrusts everyone around him. An act that appears to be unselfish arouses his especially strong suspicion. The law of the taiga, that is how he formulates the highest imperative of human relationships. On the islands of the archipelago, there really are great tracts of taiga. The native, who in the highest degree combines and manifests these tribal qualities, the drive for life, pitilessness, resourcefulness, secretiveness, and mistrustfulness, calls himself, and is called by others, a son of Gulag. This, among them, is like the title honorary citizen, and it is acquired, of course, through long years of life on the islands. A son of Gulag believes himself impenetrable, and also that he, on the contrary, can see right through those around him, and, as the phrase goes, 6 feet beneath them, too. Maybe this is so, but at this point it becomes apparent that even the most penetrating of the Zeks possesses a narrow range of outlook, a short view ahead. While judging very soberly actions close to them, and while very precise in calculating their behavior in the hours immediately ahead, the rank-and-file Zeks, and even the sons of Gulag too, are incapable either of thinking abstractly, or of grasping phenomena of a general nature, or even of speaking about the future. Even in their grammar, the future tense is very rarely used. Even with regard to the morrow, it is applied with a conditional nuance, and still more carefully to the subsequent days of the same week, and you will never hear from a Zek such a sentence as, "Next spring I will," because they all know that they still have to make it through the winter, and that any day fate can hurl them from one island to another. In real truth, my day is my epoch. The sons of Gulag are also the chief bearers of the traditions and the so-called Zek commandments. On the various islands, the number of these commandments varies, and they are not always formulated the same way, either. And to work toward their systematization would be a very interesting subject for a separate inquiry. These commandments have nothing in common with Christianity. The Zeks are not only an atheistic people, but in general nothing is sacred to them, and they always hasten to ridicule and degrade anything lofty. And this, too, is reflected in their language. But as the sons of Gulag affirm, if you live according to their commandments, you will not perish in the archipelago. There are certain precepts, such as, "Don't squeal." How is one to understand this? Evidently they are desirous of avoiding superfluous noise. And, don't lick the bowls. In other words, do not descend to slops, something they consider a swift and abrupt way to die. And don't scavenge. And others. There is an interesting commandment. Don't shove your nose in someone else's mess tin. This seems to us to represent a great achievement of native thought. You see, this is the principle of negative freedom. It is the slogan, "My home is my castle," turned around, so to speak, and even improved upon. Because it is a matter not of one's own mess tin, but of someone else's. And yet, one's own is, of course, understood. Knowing the native conditions, we have to understand here the term mess tin in the broadest sense, not merely as a dented and sooty dish, nor even as the specific unappetizing dishwater contained in it, but also as the means of getting something to eat, all the means in the struggle for existence, and even more broadly, as the Zek's soul. In a word, let me live as I wish, and you live as you wish. That is what this precept means. A hard and cruel son of Gulag, under this precept, undertakes the obligation not to use his strength and drive out of empty curiosity, but at the same time he frees himself of any kind of moral obligation. Even if you are croaking right next to me, it's none of my affair. This is a cruel law, yet it is much more humane than the law of the thieves, the island cannibals. You today, me tomorrow. The cannibal thief is not in the least indifferent to his neighbour. He will speed up the latter's death so as to put off his own, or sometimes just for the hell of it, or even for the amusement of watching it. Finally, there is one composite commandment. Don't trust, don't fear, don't beg. In this commandment, the common national character of the Zek is cast, like a piece of sculpture, with sharp definition. How can one, in freedom, rule over a people which is totally steeped in such a proud commandment? It is awesome even to think of it. This commandment leads us to consider not so much the lifestyle of the Zeks as their psychological essence. The first thing we note from the start in a son of Gulag, and then observe more and more frequently, is spiritual equilibrium, psychological stability. In this regard, the Zek's general overall philosophical view of his place in the universe is highly interesting. As distinct from the Englishman or the Frenchman, who is proud all his life of having been born an Englishman or a Frenchman, the Zek is not at all proud of his national affiliation. On the contrary, he perceives it as a cruel trial, but a trial he wishes to endure with dignity. The Zeks have a particularly notable myth, which holds that somewhere there exist the gates of the archipelago, compare with the pillars of Hercules in antiquity, and that on the outside of these gates there is a sign for those who enter, "Do not lose heart," and on the other side there is a sign for those who are leaving, "Do not be overjoyed." And the main thing, the Zeks add, is that these signs are visible only to the wise, and fools do not see them. Often this myth is expressed as a simple rule of life. Newly arriving, do not be sad. Newly departing, do not be glad. It is in this key that the views of the Zeks on the archipelago and on the life taking place in the space abutting on it must be perceived. Such a philosophy is the source of the Zeks' psychological stability. No matter how darkly circumstances may be stacked against him, he knits the brows of his rough and weathered face and says, "They cannot drop me any deeper than a mine." Or they comfort each other, "It could be worse." And in reality, this conviction, "It could be even worse," clearly supports and encourages them in the most profound suffering of famine, cold, and spiritual depression. The Zek is always expecting it to be worse. That is how he lives, constantly awaiting the blows of fate and stings of the evil spirit. And, on the other hand, he perceives every temporary relaxation as an oversight, a mistake. In this constant expectation of misfortune, the austere soul of the Zek matures, stoically hardened to its own fate and pitiless toward the fates of others. The Zek's deviations from his state of equilibrium are very minor, either on the dark side or the bright side, either on the side of despair or on the side of happiness. This was felicitously expressed by Taras Shevchenko, who spent a little time on the islands in prehistoric times. I now have almost neither grief nor gladness. On the other hand, there is a moral calm like the cold-bloodedness of a fish. Is it possible that constant suffering can rework a human being in this way? Indeed, yes, indeed it can. A stable, indifferent state of mind is the Zek's indispensable defense, so he can survive long years of grim island life. If he does not attain this smoldering, lusterless state of mind in his first year in the archipelago, ordinarily he dies. Once he has attained it, he continues to live. In a word, if you don't kick the bucket, you'll become an adept. All the Zek's feelings are dulled and his nerves coarsened. Having become indifferent to his own grief and to the punishments which the guardians of the tribe have laid upon him, and even, by then, almost to his whole life, he does not experience any spiritual sympathy for the grief of those around him either. Somebody's outcry of pain, or even women's tears, barely compel him to turn his head, so dulled have his reactions become. Often the Zeks show no mercy to inexperienced newcomers and laugh at their errors and misfortunes. But do not judge them severely for this. They are not doing it out of malice. Their sympathies have simply atrophied, and all that remains noticeable to them is the funny side of events. The most prevalent world outlook among them is fatalism. This is their profound universal trait. It is to be explained by their dependent situation, their total lack of knowledge of what will happen to them even in the most immediate future, and their actual inability to influence events. Fatalism is even necessary to the Zek because it confirms him in his spiritual stability. The son of Gulag believes that the most tranquil course is to put his faith in fate. The future is a cat in a sack, a pig in a poke. And not understanding it clearly and having no idea what's going to happen to you in the possible variations of life lying ahead, you don't need to strive too insistently for something or reject something too obstinately, be it a transfer to another barracks, or brigade, or camp. Maybe it will be for the better, maybe for the worse, but you are free of self-reproaches. Let it be worse for you, but it wasn't done by your own hands. And this is how you preserve that precious feeling of dauntlessness, how you save yourself from fussing and ingratiating. Given such a dark fate, the Zeks have many strong superstitions. One of them is closely bound up with their fatalism. If you worry too much about your conditions or even your own comfort, you are bound to get burned by a prisoner transport. Fires, in their literal sense, don't frighten the Zeks. They don't value the shelters they live in, and they don't even try to save burning buildings, since they are certain that they will always be replaced. To get burned is a phrase used only in the sense of their personal fate. The fatalism, widely prevalent among them, extends not only to their personal fate, but also to the overall course of things. The last thing in their mind is that the overall course of events could be changed. They imagine that the archipelago has existed for all eternity, and that earlier it was even worse. But probably the most interesting psychological twist here is the fact that the Zeks perceive their own stable state of equanimity in these primitive and wretched circumstances as a victory for love of life. It is quite enough for the sequence of misfortunes to slow down a little, for the blows of fate to slacken just a little, for the Zek to express his satisfaction with life and take pride in his own conduct in it. Perhaps the reader will find it easier to believe in this paradoxical trait if we cite Chekhov. In his story, In Exile, the boatman, Semyon Tolkovy, expresses this feeling as follows. I have brought myself to the point where I can sleep naked on the earth and eat grass, and may God grant everyone a life like that. R. Italics. I need nothing, and I fear no one, and I understand myself so well that no man is richer and freer than I. These astonishing words still ring in our ears. We have heard them many times from Zeks of the archipelago. And the only surprise is, where could Chekhov have picked them up? And may God grant everyone a life like that. How would you like that? Up to the present, we have been speaking of the positive aspects of the national character, but we cannot shut our eyes to its negative aspects, to certain touching national weaknesses, which seem to stand as exceptions and contradictions of the foregoing. The more dauntless and stern the disbelief of this atheistic people, which, for example, completely ridicules the gospel teaching which says, "Judge not that ye be not judged," holding that judgments, in other words, sentences, don't depend on that, the more feverishly it is afflicted nonetheless by attacks of thoughtless gullibility. Here one can draw a distinction. Within that closely circumscribed field of vision where the Zek can see well, he believes in nothing, but deprived of an abstract vision, deprived of historical perspective, he swallows with the innocence of a savage any far-fetched rumour, any native miracles. An ancient example of native trustfulness was the hope placed in Gorky's arrival on Solovki. But there isn't any need to go that far back. There is an almost permanent and almost universal religion in the archipelago. This is faith in the so-called amnesty. It is difficult to explain just what this is. It is not the name of a goddess, as the reader might have thought. It is something akin to the second coming among Christian peoples. It is a burst of such blinding radiance that the ice of the archipelago will melt, and even the islands themselves will dissolve, and all the natives will be swept on warm waves to sunny regions where they will immediately find their nearest and most beloved. Probably this is a somewhat transformed faith in the kingdom of heaven on earth. This faith, which has never yet been confirmed by one single real miracle, is nonetheless very much alive and persistent. And just as other peoples connect their important rituals with the winter and summer solstices, so too the Zeks mystically await, always in vain, the first days of November and May. If a south wind blows on the archipelago, they will immediately whisper from ear to ear, "There's bound to be an amnesty. It is already underway." And when the winter winds set in earnest, the Zeks warm their numbed fingers by breathing on them, rub their ears, stamp up and down, and encourage one another. "That means there will be an amnesty, otherwise we'll freeze to..." Here, there is an untranslatable expression. Evidently, it's going to come now. The harmfulness of every religion has long since been demonstrated and proved, and we see the same thing here, too. These beliefs in amnesty seriously weaken the natives, inducing in them an uncharacteristic state of dreaminess, and there are periods of epidemic when necessary and urgent government work quite literally falls from the Zek's hands, which, practically speaking, is the same effect as that produced by the opposite kind of rumour about prisoner transports. For everyday construction work, it is much more advantageous for the natives not to experience any ups and downs of feeling. And the Zeks also suffer from a certain national weakness, which in some incomprehensible fashion they retain despite the whole structure of their life. This is their secret thirst for justice. Chekhov, too, observed this strange feeling on an island which, in fact, did not belong to our archipelago at all. "The hard labor prisoner, no matter how profoundly depraved and unjust he himself was, loved justice above all, and if it was not to be found among the people placed over him, then year after year he fell into a state of anger, into extreme mistrust." Even though Chekhov's observations do not in any respect refer to our case, yet they astonish us with their accuracy. Beginning with the Zeks' arrival in the archipelago, every day and every hour of their life here is one continual injustice, and in this situation they themselves commit only injustices, and one would think it had long since been time for them to grow used to it, and to accept injustice as the universal norm of life. But no, not at all. Every injustice on the part of the elders in the tribe and the tribal guardians continues to wound them, and to wound them just as much as it did on their first day. But injustice which rises from the bottom to the top provokes their hearty and approving laughter. And in their folklore they do not create legends so much about justice as, in an exaggeration of this feeling, about unjustified magnanimity. And thus it was that the myth about magnanimity to F. Kaplan was created and lasted for decades in the archipelago, alleging that she had not been shot but confined for life in various prisons, and there were even many witnesses to be found who had been with her on prisoner transports or who had received books from the Butyrki prison library from her. Not long ago, the commandant of the Kremlin, Comrade Malkov, officially repudiated these rumours and described how he had shot Kaplan at the time. And Demian Bedny was present at the execution too, and her absence as a witness at the trial of the SRs in 1922 ought to have convinced the Zecks. But they don't remember that trial at all. We suppose that the rumour about the life imprisonment of F. Kaplan arose from the life imprisonment of Berta Gandal. This woman, suspecting nothing, arrived in Moscow from Riga on the very day of the attempted assassination of Lenin, when the brothers Gandal, who had been waiting in an automobile for Kaplan, were shot. And that was why Berta got life imprisonment. One asks why the natives needed this nonsensical myth, only as an extreme case of inordinate magnanimity in which they wanted to believe. They then, in their mind's eye, could apply it to themselves. Instances are also known of a Zex coming to love his work in the archipelago. A.S. Brachikov, "I am proud of what I made with my own hands," or at least not disliking it, the Zecks of German origin. But these cases are so exceptional that we are not going to offer them even as an eccentricity, let alone a universal trait of the people. And let not the already cited native trait of secretiveness seem in contradiction with another native trait, a love of telling stories about the past. Among all backward peoples, this is a custom of the old men, and people of middle age actively dislike talking about the past, and are even afraid to, particularly women, and particularly people filling out security questionnaires, yes, and in general everyone. In this regard, the Zecks behave like a nation consisting only of old men. In another respect, since they have instructors, they are, on the contrary, maintained like a nation of children. You wouldn't be able to squeeze a word out of them about the petty secrets of today's daily life, such as where to warm up one's mess tin, or who's got makhorka to barter. But they will tell you everything about the past without concealment, disclosing everything. How they lived before the archipelago, and with whom, and how they got here. For hours at a time they listen to stories of how other Zecks got here, and they are never bored in the least by these monotonously similar stories. And the more accidental, the more superficial, the briefer the encounter between two Zecks, one night next to each other in a transit prison, the more extended and detailed are their hurried accounts of themselves to one another. It is very interesting at this point to draw comparisons with Dostoevsky's observations. He noted that each prisoner bore silently and suffered out within himself the story of how he got into the house of the dead, and found it was not acceptable among them to talk about it. This is something we can't understand. People got put in the house of the dead for crime. And for those hard labor prisoners, it was hard to think back on it. The Zec gets to the archipelago by an inexplicable move of fate, or by an evil concatenation of vengeful circumstances. But in 9 cases out of 10, he doesn't feel he has committed any crime. And therefore there are no stories in the archipelago more interesting, and none which arouse a livelier sympathy in the audience, than those of How I Got Here. The Zecks' abundant stories about the past, which filled all the evenings in their barracks, had another purpose and meaning as well. The more uncertain the Zeck's present and future, the more unshakable is his past. No one can ever take his past away from the Zeck, and everyone was something bigger in the past than he is now in the archipelago. Since it is impossible to be lower than a Zeck, and even a drunken tramp outside the archipelago is addressed as comrade. And in his recollections, therefore, the Zeck's self-esteem reclaims those peaks from which life has toppled him. And the self-esteem of an old deaf tinker or of a pipsqueak boy painter's apprentice in no way yields to that of a celebrated theatre director of the metropolis. His recollections are, in addition, invariably embellished and invented, but extremely plausible. Episodes are inserted in them. And the Zec storyteller and his listeners feel a life-giving return of self-confidence. This self-confidence is strengthened in another way, too, by multitudinous folk tales about the cleverness and luck of the Zec people. These are rather crude stories, recalling the soldiers' legends of the times of Tsar Nicholas I, when soldiers were conscripted for 25 years. They will tell you how a certain Zec went to the chief to split wood for the kitchen, and how the chief's daughter ran out to him in the woodshed, or how a sly orderly made a crawl hole underneath the barracks and put a pot under the drain in the floor of the parcel room. There was sometimes vodka in parcels from outside, but there was a prohibition law on the archipelago, and with due documentation, they were supposed to pour out all the vodka right on the ground. But they never ever did pour it out, and so this duty orderly supposedly collected it in his pot and was always drunk. In general, the Zecs value and love humour, and this is best evidence of all of the healthy psychological state of those natives who manage not to die during their first year. They proceed on the theory that tears will not justify you, nor laughter get you into debt. Humour is their constant ally, without which, very likely, life in the archipelago would be totally impossible. They value curses, too, particularly for their humour. The funnier they are, the more convincing to them. Their every reply to a question, their every judgment about their surroundings, is spiced with at least a mite of humour. Ask a Zec how much time he has spent already in the archipelago, and he will not tell you 5 years, but instead, "Well, I've sat through 5 Januaries." For some reason, they refer to their stay in the archipelago as sitting, even though they spend least of all their time sitting. "Is it hard?" you ask him. "Only the first 10 years. He replies mockingly. And if you sympathize with him because he has to live in such a difficult climate, he will reply, "The climate's bad, but the company's good." And they will say about someone who has left the archipelago, "They gave him 3, he sat out 5, and they released him ahead of time." And when prisoners began to arrive in the archipelago with excursion tickets for 25 years, "Now you'll be looked after for the next 25 years. And in general, the Zecs talk this way about the archipelago. "Whoever hasn't been there yet will get there, and whoever has been there won't forget it." This is a case of an unlawful generalization. You and I, reader, do not intend to go there at all, right? And wherever and whenever the natives hear someone ask to be given more of something, even if only hot water in a mug, they all immediately shout in a chorus, "The prosecutor will give you more." In general, the Zecs have an incomprehensible hostility toward prosecutors, and it frequently bursts out. For example, in the archipelago, the unjust expression is widespread. "The prosecutor is a chopper." Beyond its exact rhyme in Russian, we do not see any meaning in this phrase. With deep regret, we have to note here a case of the split between associative and causative connections, which reduces the Zec's thought processes below the average level common to all mankind. We will have more to say about this anon. Here are some additional examples of their cute, good-natured jokes. "He sleeps and sleeps, but has no time for rest." "If you don't drink your water, where will you get your strength?" At the end of the working day, when the Zecs are already exhausted and waiting for knocking off time, they invariably joke about the detested work. "Well, the work just got going, but the day is too short." And in the morning, instead of setting about work, they go from place to place and say, "The night should come sooner, so tomorrow we could go to work." And here is where we see the gaps in their logic. There is a well-known native expression, "We didn't plant that forest, so we won't cut it down." But if one reasons that way, the logging camps didn't plant the forest either. Yet they cut them down very successfully indeed. So what we have here is a childishness typical of the native way of thought, an idiosyncratic form of Dadaism. Or here again, from the time of the Belomore Canal, "Let the bears do the work." Well, how, speaking seriously, can one imagine a bear digging the Great Canal? The question of bears working was adequately treated in the works of I.A. Krylov. If there were the slightest possibility of harnessing bears for useful work, do not doubt that it would have been done in recent decades, and we would have whole bear brigades and labor camps for bears. True, the natives have a parallel expression about bears, which is highly unjust but caustic. "The chief is a bear." We cannot even understand what association of ideas could give rise to such an expression. We would not like to think so ill of the natives as to combine the two expressions and draw a conclusion on that basis. Going on to the question of the Zec's language, we find ourselves in somewhat of a quandary. Without even mentioning the fact that each study of a newly discovered language always calls for a separate book and a special scientific course, there are specific difficulties in our case. One of them is the agglomerative combination of language with cursing, to which we have already referred. No one could possibly separate them, because one cannot divide a living thing. Only recently a certain Stalevskaya from the village of Dolgod Erevenskoye of Chelyabinsk province found a way. Why did you not struggle for the purity of the language? Why did you not appeal to the instructor for help in an organized way? This remarkable idea simply never crossed our minds when we were in the archipelago. Otherwise, we would certainly have suggested it to the Czechs. But at the same time, we are restrained from setting down everything as it is in these scholarly pages, out of concern for the morals of our young people. There is another difficulty, the necessity of precisely distinguishing the language of the Czech people from the language of the tribe of cannibals, otherwise known as the thieves, the crooks, scattered among them. The language of the tribe of cannibals is a completely separate branch of the philological tree, which has nothing like it or akin to it. This subject is worthy of a separate inquiry, and we would only be confused by the incomprehensible cannibal lexicon, with such words as ksiva, a document, marochka, handkerchief, ugol, suitcase, lukovitsa, a watch, or prokoria, boots. But the problem is that there are other lexicographical elements of the cannibal language which have been taken over by the Czech language and which have enriched it with their images. Svistet, meaning in Russian to whistle, to sing, and in the Czech language to tell a lie, to shoot the bull. Temnit, meaning in Russian to darken, to obscure, and similarly in Czech to deceive, to confuse. Raskirivat chanukhu, meaning in Russian to cast something black over, and in Czech similarly to deceive, to throw dust in one's eyes. Kantovatsya, meaning in Russian to be tipped over, turned upside down, and in Czech to loiter, loaf on the job, but slyly. Lukatsya, meaning in Russian to feel out, and in Czech to check out the action, but swiftly. Filonet, meaning in Czech to be clever, to loaf. Mantulit, which used to mean in Russian to lick the plates of the master's table, and which now means in Czech to get stuck in, to slave away. Svet, meaning in Russian color, including skin color, and in Czech, appertaining, belonging to the Russian thieves' law. Poluzvet, meaning in Russian half-breed, mulatto, and in Czech, half-thief. Dukhovoy, meaning in Russian pertaining to the spirit, or wind, as in wind instrument, and in Czech, courageous, fearless, reckless. Kondei, meaning in Russian and in Czech, the cooler, the punishment block. Shmon, meaning in Czech, a frisk, a body search. Kostil, meaning a crutch in Russian, and in Czech, the bread ration. Fitil, meaning a wick in Russian, and in Czech, a prisoner worn down and dying. Chestyorka, meaning in Russian something with six elements, or scoring 6 points. And in Czech, someone working for the camp administration or for the thieves or trustees. Sotolovka, meaning in Russian something sucked on or which sucks, and in Czech, a starvation situation. Otritsalovka, meaning in Russian something which is a denial, a disclaimer, and in Czech, a rejection of everything demanded by the camp chiefs, usually on the part of the central hardcore of thieves. Spontom, meaning in Russian, with the style of a card player who plays against the bank. And in Czech, very much the same, bluffing but with braggadocio, with theatrics. Gumoznitsa, meaning in Czech, a prostitute, a camp lay. Shalashovka, derived from the Russian shalash, meaning a lean-into shelter, a shack, and meaning in Czech, a shack-up, a girlfriend. Batsili, meaning in Russian, bacilli, and in Czech, fats and oils. Kiliat pod blatnogo, meaning in Czech, to imitate the ways of the Russian thieves. Zabladnitsya, meaning in Czech, to take up the ways of the Russian thieves. Many of these words, one must admit, possess precision, vividness, even a general comprehensibility. Their crowning glory, however, is the shout, Na Tsirlach! This can be translated into Russian only by a complex description. To run or to serve something, Na Tsirlach, means on tiptoe and headlong and with heartfelt zeal and eagerness, and all of it simultaneously. Now, it seems clear to us that the contemporary Russian language is in real need of this expression, particularly because action of that kind is often encountered in life. But such concern is already, in fact, superfluous. The author of these lines, having completed his lengthy scientific journey through the archipelago, was extremely worried about being able to return to his teaching in the Ethnographic Institute, not merely as regards his security clearance, but also as to whether he had fallen behind contemporary Russian language and whether the students would understand him all right. And suddenly, then and there, with astonishment and delight, he heard from the first-year students the very same expressions his ears had grown used to in the archipelago, and in which the Russian language had been so deficient till now. Skodu, meaning right away, or with a rush, or crashing on. Zio Dorogo, meaning all the way, all the time. Ponovoi, meaning once again. Raskurochit, meaning to rob, to clean out. Zanachit, meaning to stash, to swipe. Frayer, meaning a sucker, or anyone not belonging to the thieves' law. Duraki ushi kolodnie, meaning literally a fool with cold ears, 100% fool. Ona sepanyami shiotya, meaning literally, she gets herself sewed up with the boys, she makes out with the boys, and many, many others. What this indicates is the great energy of the Czech language, which helps it to filter inexplicably into our country, and first of all into the language of our young people. This offers the hope that in the future the process will accelerate, and that all the words enumerated previously will also flow into the Russian language, and will perhaps even be an ornament to it. But this makes the task of the researcher even more difficult, to separate the Russian language and the Czech language. And then, too, conscientiousness prevents our bypassing a fourth difficulty, some primary and sort of prehistoric influence of the Russian language itself on the Czech language, and even on the language of the cannibals, although now such an influence cannot be observed. How otherwise can it be explained that we find in Dahl's dictionary analogies to such specifically archipelago expressions? Sit zakonom, literally, to live in the law, and meaning, in the Kostroma district, to live with a wife. In the archipelago, to live with her in the law. Vienachit, to fish out of a pocket, in the Russian peddler's language. And in the archipelago, they switched the prefix, zanachit, to steal. Podkodit, meant to become impoverished, to become fagged out. Compare dokhodit in the archipelago, to get fagged out to the point of death, to be a dying man, a last legger. Or one can consider the proverbs collected by Dahl as well. Cabbage soup is good people. And a whole series of island expressions. Morodschelovek, meaning a frost person, if he is not strong. Kostyorchelovek, literally a bonfire person, etc. And we also find in Dahl, he doesn't catch mice. And the word suka, bitch, meant a spy or stoolie back in the times of P.F. Yakubovich. And then there is that remarkable expression of the natives, to dig your horns in, referring to every kind of work stubbornly executed, and in general to all stubbornness, to standing up for yourself. And then, too, to knock his horns down, or to knock his horns off, which restores to contemporary life precisely the ancient Russian and Slavonic meaning of the word horns, conceit, haughtiness, disdain. Despite the phrase borrowed and translated from the French, put horns on, someone describing a wife's unfaithfulness, a phrase which never caught on among the ordinary people, and which even the Russian intelligentsia would have forgotten, had it not been bound up with Pushkin's duel. And all these innumerable difficulties force us for the time being to put off the linguistic portion of our inquiry. In conclusion, a few personal lines. The Czechs at first shied away from the author of this essay when he questioned them. They supposed that these inquiries were being conducted for the benefit of the Godfather, a guardian spiritually close to them, to whom, however, as to all their guardians, they are ungrateful and unjust. When they became convinced that this was not the case, and after they had been plied with macaca to smoke from time to time, they did not smoke expensive varieties, they adopted a kindly attitude toward the researcher, disclosing their unspoiled inner natures. In some places they even began in a friendly way to nickname the researcher Dil Tomatovich, and in others Fanfanich. It has to be pointed out that patronymics are not employed at all in the archipelago, and that therefore this form of respectful address bore a humorous character. Simultaneously it expressed how inaccessible to their intellect was the meaning of this study. The author considers that the present inquiry has succeeded, and that his hypothesis has been fully proved, namely that in the middle of the 20th century a completely new nation has been discovered, unknown to anyone before, with the ethnic scope of many millions of people. Chapter 20. The Dog's Service. The title of this chapter was not intended as an intentionally scathing insult, but it is our duty to uphold the camp tradition. If you think about it, they themselves chose this lot. Their service is the same as that of guard dogs, and their service is connected with dogs. And there even exists a special statute on service with dogs, and there are whole officers' committees which monitor the work of an individual dog, fostering a good viciousness in the dog. And if the maintenance of one pup for a year costs the people 11,000 pre-Khrushchev rubles, police dogs are fed better than prisoners, then the maintenance of each officer must cost even more. All this about the dogs comes from Metter's novella Murat. And then, throughout this book, we have also had the difficulty of knowing what to call them in general. The administration, the chiefs, are too generalized and relate to freedom as well, to the whole life of the whole country, and their shop-worn terms anyway. The bosses, likewise, the camp managers, but this is a circumlocution that only demonstrates our impotence. Should they be named straightforwardly in accordance with camp tradition? That would seem crude, profane. It would be fully in the spirit of the language to call them Lagerstchiki, camp keepers. This distinguishes them every bit as well from the Lagernik, camp inmate, as does Tioremchik, prison keeper, from Tioremnik, prison inmate. And it expresses an exact and unique sense, those who manage and govern the camps. And so, asking forgiveness of my stricter readers for this new word, and it is not entirely new if a vacant spot was left for it in the language, I shall from now on make use of it from time to time. And that is what this chapter is about, the camp keepers, and the prison keepers with them. This book is continued on Cassette 8, Side 1.